Welcome to this episode of Just the Disc. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. I have my good friend Stephanie Crawford joining me. Hello, Steph.
Hello, Brian.
So I love following Steph on Twitter for many reasons, mostly for my own sanity, for the humor she provides. But occasionally something fun will happen where one of us will post about a movie and I'll suddenly find out about a movie that I didn't know Steph was a huge fan of, and then comes an episode of this show. So that's kind of fun. In this case, I was watching or posting about Cleopatra Jones, I think, and you responded, maybe?
Yeah, it sounds about right.
Yeah, and I was just like, oh, Steph likes Cleopatra Jones. We should talk about Cleopatra Jones. And then I saw Steph had ordered Superfly from the Warner Archives sale. And so I was like, oh, this is coming together lovely. Let's do a show that's sort of blaxploitation centric. And they happen to both be Warner Archive Blu-rays. So we got a little label, you know.
Synchronicity.
Thank you very much. I needed that. Yes. So that's cool, too. So anyway, that was the impetus for tonight's episode. And
that seems to be the way we get most of our episodes going.
It's true. It does happen that way sometimes, you know.
I should just start testing you and just start naming, like, oh, I love Pauly Shore movies. I could talk for hours.
You think I'll take that bait, huh?
I don't know. Jury Duty. I think there's a lot there.
Isn't that coming on Blu-ray? I think Jury Duty.
Did I just drop a hint? I just turned to a non-existent audience.
Clearly,
what do you guys think?
Clearly, we're doing Jury Duty and then Biodome. That's got to happen.
Awesome.
I mean, why not? But so, Steph, is Cleopatra Jones an old favorite, a new favorite? How do you feel about it, and why do you love it?
If I ever hear of you selling so much as a cough drop, I'm coming down on you so hard.
Tamara Dobson, the Soul Sisters' answer to James Bond, and the most exciting new star in years. 6 feet two of dynamite, and it's all stacked.
I told you where, and I told you when, and I told you how to get that Cleopatra Jones. She is sticking her nose in my business, Zach!
And up against her is the archenemy, the female successor to Goldfinger. Two-time Academy Award winner Shelley Winters as Mommy.
It is an old favorite for me. My first serious boyfriend actually showed it to me. Just randomly, I was a teenager, and he's like, there's this movie called Cleopatra Jones. I was like, well, that's cool. That's a cool name. So I was picturing, I don't know, like Cleopatra in modern day or something like that. And he showed me the cover, and this is back with the snapper case DVD. And I was like, okay, that looks amazing. I had, you know, no experience with blaxploitation movies or anything like that. So he played it and I fell in love with it. I had never seen a film remotely like it. So Cleopatra Jones was actually my introduction to the entire genre.
Oh, that's cool.
Right. Like, you know, Pam Grier is the figurehead, but she wasn't my first. When I think of women in the genre, you know, I have to think of Ms. Dobson.
She's something else, that Tamara Dobson. She's really something else.
No, like just literally a towering figure. I think 6'2". At least that's how the trailer sells her, because she's a model.
Yeah.
It's funny. I didn't jump into the genre immediately after that. And I'm old. There wasn't streaming or anything. So you kind of had to come upon things and you found them. But that definitely planted a seed. And with Jackie Brown, I think, was coming out around that time period.
Oh, nice.
No, that was before, but I wasn't very familiar with it. So it opened up a new world. So Cleopatra Jones is one of those films I have to temper how I talk about it with other people, because I can get just a little too excited about it. And I remember, okay, I'm not telling this to a 17-year-old who's never seen this kind of film before.
Well, I think there's a reason to be excited about Cleopatra Jones. And I had forgotten how much I like it. Like, in rewatching it on this Blu-ray, which looks lovely, by the way. I don't know how you felt about the transfer.
No, it was fantastic. And that seems to be a trend with Warner Archive.
Absolutely.
They keep the grain. It still looks like a film. You know, they Absolutely. Don't try to make it look like a glossy modern day film. It looks exactly like a 1970s film, like it should, but cleaned up, beautiful. Yeah, it's a great transfer.
Yeah, it's a bummer that, and I mean, I'll continue to do it, but that I'm always feel like I have to bang the drum for them, because I feel like people still are under the impression that, well, A, that they do like burn on demand Blu-rays
right.
or something.
I think that's a huge hurdle for a lot of people, because that's how yeah. it was for years.
Totally. Yeah. And I get that. Well, A, I mean, you and I both know they never did burn on demand Blu-rays, but that said, they did do burn on demand DVDs yeah. and they still do. So it's confusing, right? But I think the thing that's tricky is that they also don't always have extras on their Blu-rays, like Cleopatra Jones, unfortunately, does not. So I think people devalue them on that level, which is fair, you know, okay. But what's tricky is that people will accept, you know, some, you know, old ass master from another, you know, smaller label and maybe minimal extras and get really excited about it. And I'm one of those people, certainly, but not get excited about a brand new.
I was wondering who you were throwing shade at.
Myself. But I'm just saying, like, if you know, if you get excited about certain Code Red releases, certain Scorpion releases, and I do, I know that that's a bad example actually right now, because I feel like they're actually putting more work into a lot of their stuff, and I haven't even had a chance to dig into the new Opera disc, but I've heard you sing the praises of it, so I know it's good stuff.
Oh,
right.
Right. I haven't even been able to watch anything because there's three different cuts of the film on it.
Yeah.
So that's intimidating, and I've seen the movie quite a few times, and I watched it again last year, and I'm not someone who can rewatch a film right after each other unless it's, you know, with a commentary. I have to space things out yeah. a little bit. But there's a new commentary on the Opera disc, so I'm excited for that.
Yeah. So scrap that example. That's not a great example on my part, because I'm talking about one of the better right. releases of 2019 probably, and I'm bagging on the company. I'm not trying to bag on them. But what I'm saying is, a lot of times, you know, there's not any kind of cleanup or restoration being done with the Blu-rays we're buying, and that's fine, but let's give a little props to the people that are taking the time to do it and make their discs look good, and Warner Archive does that. I have not yet come across one that didn't look fantastic. So bottom line, if you're looking for a good-looking movie, you're never going to go wrong with them, you know, so just keep that in mind. And the sales, when they happen, which they seem to be happening a little more frequently.
No complaints.
I'm seeing more people diving in, which is great.
Yeah, I was thinking with Code Red, maybe Baby Needs a New Pair of Shoes, which doesn't look terrible, but not a lot of care is put into that one, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah. They've done a few like that, you know, where you're just like, okay, you just found some collector print and transfer that. And I get that some of these movies are going to be tougher, and these are studio films, so they should ideally be in better shape to begin with. But anyway, I was really impressed with the Cleopatra Jones Blu-ray. The whole movie is so much fun. It's befitting a fun movie to have it look so good. But yeah, you're right about Tamara. She is a badass. Like, I love Pam Grier. My heart mm-hmm. belongs to Pam Grier, but Tamara is like, she's quite the runner up. She's quite the challenger. I gotta say. Yes, she's something else. Just because of her presence, her height and everything, the way that she moves, you know, I mean, it's different than Pam Grier in a lot of ways. And yeah, I forgot how much I like her on screen. She just has a really star power thing about her, you know, that Pam Grier has too, but I don't know. She's like, in this movie, she's like a Marvel superhero, you know, like she drives a killer Corvette.
Is kung fu
and yeah, she knows kung fu. Is she like,
does some motor
a special
cross
agent
for a second? Yeah, she models as a cover, but she's a secret agent.
Lou, line 4, it's Cleo. She's hot.
She know I'm here.
Hello.
Cleo, welcome back.
Don't give me that welcome jive. What's going on, Lou? I thought I had a friend down there.
I don't know what the hell happened. Whoever planned it knew exactly when I couldn't be reached.
Who ordered the bust?
I don't have any answers. All I know for sure is it came from pretty high up.
That figures.
I heard about the rumble at the airport. We got a positive ID on the corpse and a couple of maybes on the other two.
Are you okay?
My body's okay.
It's magnificent.
About the airport?
Forget about the airport, Lou. We've got things to talk about.
Shoot.
Not on the phone, baby. Art's place in an hour.
Okay. Oh, and Cleo, if I'd have been here, they wouldn't have gone near that house.
Okay.
But I'm with. She does have a presence. For one thing, she is gorgeous.
Yes, she is.
That kind of gorgeous where she's just perfect looking, where her face is very youthful, but she can also be very sexy. And she has that like perfect, tall, slender, but curvy model body, and her clothes, which are big deal in blaxploitation films.
For sure.
Are like, I'm anti-fur, except for Cleopatra Jones. Because these outfits, if you're not going to run out and see this film, which you should, just Google her. Just Google the images. And these are some exquisite outfits. Like, sometimes when you see very 1970s outfits, you're like, oh, that's ridiculous. Hers, you see them like, okay, that's very 1970s, but I want to wear that now. That looks amazing.
Absolutely. And it's unfortunate because I was thinking about it, and I don't think Pam Grier was given an opportunity to look this good in terms of wardrobe. It seems like wardrobe was certainly secondary in a lot of the films that Pam Grier was doing on lower budgets and such. So we haven't really seen a fair Pepsi challenge between these two in terms of the outfits.
Well, it's a different situation too, because Pam Grier is stunning. No one can argue that, but she has more, she's more average woman's height. Everything with Tamara Dobson, she could actually get top designers who are making like sample clothing in her size, and she already has those connections. So with Pam Grier, she's working with kind of like, I feel like she's working with a lot of budget costume departments most of the time.
Probably wearing a lot of her own clothes.
I was going to say, yeah. So she always looked fantastic, but yeah, she definitely wasn't known for being kind of a display for the clothing.
Yeah. I feel like maybe like Friday Foster a little bit, or Sheba Baby, one of those, she got a little bit more. But yeah, no. So I don't know. In the wake of all the Marvel movies, I was just like, this is a lot of fun. This is, you know, the blaxploitation Marvel movie that I really wanted right now. And I hadn't seen it in a really long time. So I
really
forgot.
What was your introduction to it?
If I remember correctly, my first blaxploitation movie was Shaft. And I'm trying to remember, I don't know if I went too deep after that either. So I think it was a while before, you'll find this amusing. So one of my really good friends from college, he's still a good friend of mine now. I moved out to LA with him in 99. I met him in a film class. It was making films. It was 16mm sync sound production shorts, you know. And he had this book called That's Blaxploitation, I believe, which is a really neat little book. It's a paperback book, and I liked this guy. I thought he was cool, and I knew a little bit about blaxploitation, but I kind of like faked my way into his good graces by pretending I knew a little bit more about blaxploitation than I did. And so I remember looking at the book and going, wow, I haven't seen a lot of these movies, but I'm going to pretend that I have. And it worked. And then by the time I got to know him, I could slowly catch up on actually seeing some blaxploitation movies. And so, you know, I don't know that he ever found me out. I don't know that I ever admitted that to him. I may have at some point, probably.
But what if he listens to this and becomes infuriated?
Well,
like, what if this destroys your relationship?
It will definitely not. I don't know that he listens to my podcast, which is totally fine. But if he does,
it's totally fine. I don't mind. It's fine.
You know, I don't know that he's a podcast guy. I mean, or he's not. I don't know. It's one of those things. We're good. We're still really good friends. Like, he was texting me the other day when he was at the Film Noir Festival at the Egyptian. And, you know, so I'll get texts from him every once in a while. And we're still in touch. But he's never once said, hey, great show, or anything like that. So I don't think he listens.
Okay,
but
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to question your whole friendship.
It's ruined. It's a sham. It's totally a sham. Anyway, I got off on a long tangent there. But so Shaft was my introduction. And then I think this one might have been early on, actually, because it was available, because it's a studio picture, and because, you know, the Blockbuster I was working at probably had a copy of it. And so I probably saw it soon after that. But I want to say, and this may go for just me, but I may have seen it too early. And I know it was your first, so that's maybe not applicable to some. But for me, I think I hadn't fully gotten a sense of the highs and lows of the genre. And so I didn't really know what to make of it, or it didn't impress me in the same way. Or I think I was just so high on Shaft that I was just like, well, this isn't Shaft, or something. But I don't remember being that impressed with it at the time. And I don't know what my deal was. I don't know that I knew Pam Grier that well. So my whole background in that area of cinema was weak, and it may have affected my outlook. But watching it this time, probably, I think only for the second time, maybe in my life, I was just like so entertained by it. So much fun. And I mean, between it being directed by Tarantino favorite Jack Starrett, who did the Dion Brothers and Race with the Devil. And Race with the Devil, by the way, anybody that hasn't seen Race with the Devil, get on that shit. It's great. But so between that and then like Shelley Winters as like the heavy, who is like a big time drug dealer woman and freaks out.
Yeah, blazing red curly hair, like Annie from Hell hair. You know what? Yes. I have always had deep affection for Shelley Winters. And I kind of wondered about that, because as I got older and I discovered more of the strange films she was in, I'm like, God, she's always great, but I've loved her long before. And I realized it was because I think this is also my first Shelley Winters movie.
What? That bitch! That goddamn black bitch! Oh, how dare she mess around with my puppies! My God, everybody in Turkey must be flying! I'll kill her! I will kill her! $30 million up in smoke! Goddamn, are that troublemaking clothes!
Here's some brandy. It'll calm your nerves.
Oh, thank you, Eva, darling. You're the only one around here gives a shit about Mommy. Well, now,
as long as she's over there, nothing's gonna get through. I want her black ass back here.
Mother, darling, nobody can make her do anything.
Yeah, my little sweet son, Brucey. You ever heard of the B&S house? Her own little private synanon?
Yes, Mother.
Well, if something were to happen to her own little pet Charity, she'd be on the next plane back here. Hey, that's it. That is it!
Whoa, that's awesome.
So I think that just planted the seed of being like far, far too loyal to her.
No, I don't think that's possible. I think she's great, and she's done so much good work in so many different types of movies, from the very prestigious to the, you know, very not. She always,
like in the trailer, they say Oscar nominated Shelley Winter.
Yeah, no, she's great. And yeah, I just, there's something about her and the way that she commits to performance.
Yes, that's the thing, because sometimes you'll see more of the, let's say, highfalutin actors do lower budget or even exploitation films, and you can kind of see the pain and maybe a little bit of humiliation in their performance. You never got that with Shelley Winters. She always committed. She always sold it, and she kind of always seemed like she was having a blast. Like, she was really in it for the experience of acting.
Absolutely.
Like, if it turned out to be prestigious, cool, you know? Maybe she'd have a better vacation that year, but otherwise, I think she just loved the whole experience, and that's contagious to me because she is a cartoon villain in this in Cleopatra Jones.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a couple different clips of her freaking out in this okay. movie, and I'll probably have to include both because they're both a lot of fun.
I'm tired of being a pussycat. Pick it up, you damn idiot. The revenues in the Night District are embarrassing. And you know why? Because there's no respect. There is no fear. Thank you, Gerda, darling. Oh, Gerda. You're the only one around here who understands, Mommy.
Yes, Mommy.
Well, Doodlebug hasn't paid us a nickel in a week. And you know why? Because he does not fear us. Do-gooders are running all over the district. And you know why? Because they do not fear us. Cleopatra Jones. She is sticking her nose in my business, Zap. In my business. Well, the honeymoon is over.
Mother, please.
There's other great chemistry and other actors. Like you and I were both commenting on how much we like the Tamara Dobson Norman Fell chemistry. He's like her liaison, sort of like what the Charlie's Angels
in the sequel
boss type. Oh, isn't he in this one too though?
No.
Oh, I don't know why I thought he was in the first one. Are you sure?
Well, not anymore.
Maybe crazy. Okay, well now I'm not sure. But I could have sworn that he came back for this one. Maybe he's only in the sequel. Well, that sucks. I don't know how I made the note that they had good chemistry and I must be crazy.
You just love him so much. You want him to be in everything.
But I watched Cleopatra Jones first, so like I can't believe that I thought that he was in this movie and that I made that note. Or maybe I made that note after the fact. Maybe someone.
That's what I'm gonna guess.
Yeah. All right. Well, we can talk about his chemistry in the sequel then. Who's her boss in this one? Is it somebody that we know, or it's not really? It's a nobody.
Well, I'm gonna throw credit to Captain Crawford, played by the great Dan Frazier, yeah. Who I'm not familiar with. Though he's in a lot of classic yes. shows like Kojak and
oh yeah,
Kojak.
Oh yeah, okay.
But they
now
had
I remember
great chemistry.
The bald
too.
White
I
guy.
Love her. So she's reporting back to the man, basically. But they're it's not the kind of situation like, oh, that bitch again. Which in some of these movies, even if a woman has the power position and she's the protagonist in the movie, they'll kind of have the like the old boys club kind of trash talk her. That and I love that that's not the situation here. They love her, but they also respect her, and some of them fear her a little bit.
Yes,
and it's
yes,
more
they should.
Of the fear of letting her down. And it's actually really cute. Like when Cleopatra talks, and she's very charming. She doesn't have to raise her voice. Really, just like one eyebrow if she really needs to. And everyone listens and everyone respects her. And I love that. And yeah, it's, but it feels like they're all on the same level because they give her respect. And guess what? Filmmakers mostly from decades ago, so it doesn't impact anything. But you can have men and women work together and there's still tension and action. It's still fun. Like everyone trash talking each other for no reason doesn't magically make it a good movie.
Agreed. Yeah, no, it's great. And she is, you know, definitely the head of the show. Like she is the main attraction. And everybody's there to support her and they do a good job. I mean, people like Antonio Fargas playing Doodlebug,
the best name.
It's a great name. And I wrote down a line from him where he says something like,
"Ain't nothing wrong with your ears."
"But Mommy ain't gonna like that one bit."
"That's right. And when Mommy doesn't like something, Mommy can be very bad."
"That's right."
"Plug, how's it gonna look on my death certificate?"
Huh?
"Died of that's right aside. One more that's right. About a half a second off your ass. Mommy wants trouble. I'm not exactly known as Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farms."
Which I thought was funny. But then Bernie Casey is in the movie. Love Bernie Casey.
Now, yeah, her love interest. fantastic chemistry.
Yes.
Again, a romantic relationship where they support each other. It's still sexy as hell.
Yeah, but he is by no means like trying to get out in front of her, I don't feel like. He's supportive in a way that's really sweet.
Yeah, they both have their own separate missions in life.
Yeah.
He's trying to just get rid of drugs. He's trying to help people get off drugs. And she's doing that. And she has that same goal in a much broader, more violent, spectacular way. Absolutely. Where he's more like, you know, sitting with junkies, trying to help them get through.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's for a big studio movie. It has some definite positive messages it's trying to put out. I always get conflicted about studio movies that do that kind of thing though sometimes, because I'm like, are you guys just pandering here, or is this, it feels genuine. It feels like it's coming from not a disingenuous place.
No, I feel like there's a lot of sincerity through this whole movie.
Yeah, I think that's something I respond to definitely with it.
I will say the weak spots are probably the fight scene. I don't think Ms. Dobson is a deeply trained fighter.
I think she gets better in the sequel.
Yeah, she does. I mean, it's, they're still engaging to watch because the set pieces are a lot of fun, and her legs are so long.
Yes.
That it almost seems like it's a production just completely lifting them and just landing it like on the back of a guy's head.
Yes, I agree.
Oh, I noticed something though, and maybe I mean pointing it out, but I can't help it.
Go for it.
So when I was watching it again, there's this great scene where she's going into a house and she knows something's about to go down. She gets to the second floor and there's like a little old woman being pushed in a wheelchair by someone and their backs are to her. And then all of a sudden you're now, and they turn around and throw the blanket off and they start shooting at her, but they're too slow and she gets them and they both fly through the window behind them.
Okay.
And it looks like one of the stuntmen had wet himself.
Oh yeah, I noticed that too.
You did? Okay. I was like, oh no. They really had one take, I guess.
Yeah, it is bizarre. I don't understand what that was about. I was trying to figure out like what else that could have been, if there was like maybe one of the prop weapons was leaking or something. But yeah, it's
very obvious from the back. And when he lands, you see the front and it's there too. I mean, if I was flying through a window, I would wet myself too.
Well, okay, this is the one that was in the wheelchair, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe let's take this one further. Maybe he was really committed to the old lady disguise, and he went as far as to make it an incontinent old woman, and actually wanted to smell like piss and to throw her off. That's just.
But you know what? I salute that commitment, because that is method above and beyond.
I think that's probably what happened. I think it's.
I think so too. I think you're right.
Story depth.
I'm glad I brought this up.
That's so funny you noticed that. I definitely did too. And I was like, I didn't back it up, but I thought about backing it up. I was like,
I backed.
What was. Pretty sure that guy's crotch was wet. Anyway, that is a good bit. Another thing I like about this that's kind of cool is that it's got an LA, well, it's an LA movie, so I like LA movies. There's a decent amount of LA driving and locations, and it has an LA River chase. And it might that be famous. One of the earliest LA River chases. I mean, Point Blank famously has a scene in the LA River. I don't remember if it's an actual car chase, though. I'm blanking on that scene. I may be wrong, but it's very much reminded me of the chase scene in Greece, which was, you know, 3 or 4 years later, and the car race scene there. And I was like, did the producers of Greece watch Cleopatra Jones and go, we need a LA River chase? Because maybe that happened. I don't know. But I thought
I'm
that
glad
was cool.
You brought that up, because I'd like to ask you a question as an LA local.
Yes.
So there's water down there during this race.
Yes.
Like a good deal of it. And I feel like they may not allow that. And I'm wondering, I'm like, okay, did they want water there because it looked more cinematic or more dangerous? Or did they get the okay to film there on a certain day and they couldn't afford or weren't able to move it, so they had to deal with the water? And I almost feel like it wouldn't be allowed today.
Well, yeah, that I don't know. The last time I remember a good L.A. River chase was in Terminator 2, and that was like 1994. Mm-hmm. So,
and that was dry.
Yeah, 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 you're right. No, I think there's still water in it, depending on weather. And I'm just looking up the Wikipedia for the L.A. River right now because I'm kind of actually kind of curious.
I was just trying about feeling because it's like top of the tire high just about.
Yeah, no, it is really, I'm very curious about what the aqueduct situation was in LA in at the time this movie came out, because it seems like there is a great deal of water in there, much more than I'm used to. So yeah, I don't know. You've stumped me on this one, actually. I'm not sure what the deal is, but it doesn't seem like people are doing it as much anymore, which is too bad, because I always like a good LA River scene. So I don't know. It's a very cinematic location, with water or without. It feels like, I don't know, this enclosed half tunnel. It feels like,
what are they called? The Bronson Caves?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like, yeah. It's like that. When you see that, you're like, oh,
yeah.
Hey, you, how you doing? Say hi to your mom for me.
The Bronson Caves are adorable. I haven't been there in a while, but you just reminded me. So I need to go do that again. Got to take Raven there. That'd be fun.
Oh, yeah.
Got to get her back into Batman first, and then we'll go to the Bronson Caves. All right, so what else do we have to say about Cleopatra Jones before we move on to the sequel?
Don Cornelius is Don Cornelius in it. So nice. All you Soul Train fans, you need this for your collection. Yeah, I'm disappointed there aren't any extras. It's, you know, there are plenty of people out there who I'm sure you've heard from. They say they don't watch extras, they don't have the time, or they don't have the inclination. And I think we're here talking to each other because we are fans of extras.
Sure.
So I'm not going to lie and say I'm not disappointed that they didn't do something for it. But knowing as Warner Archive, I had no expectations. But I think the film is vibrant and fun enough that it's worth getting. And I have a weird thing where I like it when they don't do any restoration to the trailers. I like seeing them all gritty.
No, I'm with you, actually.
And it's a gritty trailer. They didn't do anything to it. So if you're like us, that's a plus. But
no, that is cool.
Oh, and in my opinion, the big finale, I love it so much. It's in a like a car lot where they destroy cars. And I think it's just so well executed and gruesome without actually showing anything. There's like real tension there, but it's also kind of daffy and cartoonish too, with just Shelley Winters yelling like, "Crush him! Oh, he wants to let you drop him!" It's just a blast. This movie just makes me really happy.
Yeah, no, it is a whole lot of fun. Definitely. Now, having rewatched it and considering my other, you know, blaxploitation favorites, things like Trouble Man, Truck Turner, I would put this up there with those, you know.
Oh, would you? With the Men? Nice of you.
With the Men, yes. No, but just as a general, you know, what you want from this kind of genre is something fun and maybe a little silly in parts, but I'm not saying this movie is that. That's more the other ones. It's more like Truck Turner. And you know, I like Shaft and Shaft in Africa and Shaft Big Score and things like that. Slaughter's Big Ripoff is pretty great. It's a really solid entertainment, and I feel silly for having underrated it so long, but I'm really glad this Blu-ray came out to remind me, which is something that happens a couple, you know, times a month. I feel like now there's some movie that I was like, I think I remember thinking that was okay, and then I watch it on Blu-ray and I'm like, you know, it's better than that. So one of my favorite scenes in the movie, just before we stop, is there's a great bit where Tamara parks her car outside. I can't remember. It's on the street in the city. And some kids come up to talk to her about watching her car.
Yeah. Hey, man. Come on over here, man. Man, I'm sure it's some beautiful magnesium wheels. Ain't they, will you?
Yeah.
I bet you those wheels sure will buy a lot of wine for some of the good citizens in this neighborhood.
Little brother, I sure am fond of those mag wheels, and it would just about break my heart if anything were to happen to them. Now, what do you suggest I do about that?
Well, in my considered opinion, it might be wise to find somebody to guard them for you.
And where could I find someone for such a dangerous job?
Strange we should happen along. Maxwell Woodman is my name.
And what do you think such a job is worth, Mr. Woodman?
How much do you think it's worth? $1. For $1, you get absolute protection and we'll wipe the windshield too.
Well, that sounds like the best deal in town.
And it's so great. And then when one of the kids is done and she leaves, like, he says something about like how beautiful she is and stuff.
It's like, it's right really on, cute. Cleopatra. They're so cute. I think I tweeted about them like years ago as an example of great hats in Hollywood. Because they have these amazing colorful knit hats. And yeah.
Yeah. No, they do. That's awesome. Yeah. Anyway, so that is Cleopatra Jones, which came out in 1973. I don't know if I mentioned that. And then in 1975, unfortunately, this one's not on Blu-ray, so we're going to have a brief, you know, detour here and talk about a non-Blu-ray movie with hopes that there will be a Blu-ray at some point soon. But it feels like a good time to talk about Cleopatra Jones and the Casino of Gold.
This is the Casino of Gold. Out of here, a network of narcotics and murder reaches around the globe. Here you can buy anything or anybody, any sin you can name, and some that have no name.
Lord, give me drink.
And at the very top of this pyramid of blood and dope and sin and gold, the most evil woman in the world, the Empress of Crime.
It makes no difference to me how you die. To prevent you from running.
But now she's met her match and more in 6 feet two of dynamite.
Now, sorry, had you seen this one before?
No, I didn't. I think I just love the original so much. There's part of me who wants to like save it. So there'd always be a Cleopatra Jones movie out there I hadn't seen. And part of that was but what if I hate it and it taints it? So no, up until this episode was decided, I had not seen it.
So how do you feel about it? Did you like it?
Oh, I liked it a lot.
Cool.
I still prefer the original.
Yeah.
But this one's a blast and it's so different.
Yeah, no, it is. It's really interesting. The cast changes definitely change the whole alchemy of the film. You know, instead of Shelley Winters, we have Stella Stevens, and she's like a much more kind of serious villain while still having an edge of camp to her. I like Stella Stevens a lot. I'm a huge fan of hers. And then the aforementioned Norman Fell as her contact in this movie. And they have this really great and weirdly compelling chemistry, which is really funny because Norman Fell is just like one of the schlubbiest dudes ever. And
it works though because they're so opposite.
You nearly blew up half of Hong Kong.
And I may blow up the other half before I'm through.
Now, look, you're a representative of the United States government. You just don't do things that way.
Stanley, somebody's trying pretty hard to kill this black lady, but you can bet I'm going to find out.
Now, Cleo, I am warning you.
If you point that thing at me one more time, I'm going to make you eat it. Fingernail and all.
They're just great. I'm a big Norman Fell fan. I mean, you know, beyond, you know, Three's Company, which was great, I'm always excited when I see him pop up in a movie. He's just kind of a lot of fun for me. I think the other thing about this one is that it's much more, I thought, fight heavy and action heavy. And that could be the reason that some people tout it as the better of the two. I think I might be with you in that I maybe prefer the other one, but the fight scenes in this are pretty good. And I liked the finale is like this big fight scene in like a hotel, I think. And it seemed like it could have been maybe an influence on something like Kill Bill, you know, like the
I could definitely see that. Yeah,
right. Yeah, I just felt like that might. So anyway, it's a pretty epic fight too, because it's like 15 minutes long at the end of the movie. And so there are things I definitely enjoyed about it. But
yeah, I mean, it's set in Hong Kong, you have to up the ante with the fighting.
Yes.
Oh, and it's interesting that you did mention Stella Stevens' character. Both her and Shelley Winters, the antagonist, they're both lesbians.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, it's actually, there's, they don't say, hi, I'm a lesbian, but, you know, it's really clear.
Pretty so close.
That's a, you know, that's an issue.
Yes. Yes, it doesn't necessarily work that well.
And I'm sorry, can I go into something kind of strange?
Yes.
That some people might not notice, but involves makeup?
Well, I was just going to say, Cleo's makeup choices in this movie, in a word, bold.
So you noticed. That makes me really happy.
Oh, yeah. And she's got this crazy, like, almost like windblown makeup where it's just like on the side of her face and it goes fully back a ways past her eyes. So it's like she's really committed to like a full facial stripes kind of thing happening. But go into your makeup story. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I'm really glad you noticed. Okay. So in Cleopatra Jones, she looks perfect. Her hair, perfect. Clothes, flawless. Makeup, exquisite. Just beautiful. It doesn't look dated. It's not like that corny, like powder blue eyeshadow that was popular at the time. It's expertly done. And a lot of times, black actresses really got the short shift when it came to getting their makeup done for film, because most makeup artists were white people who worked on other white people. But she was perfect in every lighting. It was, if you care about makeup, you just notice that it's just wonderful makeup. In the sequel, it's kind of terrible. It's not applied very well. It doesn't suit her coloring very well. It's very chalky. And yes. I kind of suspected, I'm like, oh, did she have someone who was either black or who knew how to work with black skin and lighting and color? And they didn't have that. So I looked into it.
Oh.
And for Cleopatra Jones, it was Leo Letito Jr., who his filmography is too massive to get into. He did mostly TV, like V, but he also did Blowout from De Palma.
Oh,
like
cool.
Just a huge, you know, yeah, an older white guy, but he knew what he was doing and he respected her beauty. Would you like to know who the makeup artist was for Cleopatra Jones in the Casino of Gold?
I think it was Tamara Dobson.
It was Tamara Dobson. So you might think, why, you know, she has to do her makeup every day. It should have been good. Well, a lot of models and actresses don't know how to do their hair and makeup. It's always done for them and they don't bother with it if they don't have to. Because they just get sick of having to sit there for hours on the set. And makeup you do day to day is very different from the makeup you would do for a film camera. Lighting changes it. The actual lens changes how it's perceived. And it kind of sucks because I just don't think it was her forte. And I don't know if it's a budget issue or whatever, but when I saw it was her, I was like, oh no.
Yeah, I think that was part of the reason I may have noticed that credit or something, but because it is so, yeah, it's pretty heavy duty. And the other thing was that she's committed to it, I think, for the whole movie. I think she stays with that look pretty much the whole movie, right?
Yeah, I mean, she didn't go for, there are some variations, but it wasn't a subtle look. It really was kind of almost an editorial makeup look, but not executed with the precision that kind of thing needs. So it was to the point of distraction, actually.
It is a little distracting. I mean, thankfully, once she's like kicking ass and like fighting and stuff, like I'm not seeing it as much. But in the opening scenes especially, you're just like, oh my, okay. But I mean, you know what's funny is that she is so beautiful and so has that presence that she can almost, and I say almost, pull it off, you know? And she kind of, and there's part of me that's like, is she pulling it? She's pulling it off. Like I could, like, cause I would, it's so bold and so out there that I'm like, you know, if anybody could pull this off, Tamara Dobson could pull this off. So maybe she is.
Well, she doesn't look ugly. She looks like a stunning woman with makeup that needed a little more put into it.
Yeah, that's so funny. That's cool. I like we had a makeup discussion because it's definitely, you can't.
Yeah, I knew one day I'd get that.
Well, you can't not watch both movies and not notice the difference, you know, so. But I do think it's awesome that you noticed who did it in both. And Tamron. Anyway, so Cleopatra Jones, you know, maybe not as good as the original, but I think worth watching, and I think a lot of fun to watch close to the original personally, because I just wanted more Cleopatra Jones, and it was great to get that. It is available streaming in high def on various platforms right now, but I'm hoping that Warner Archive will put it out, because I'd love to have both movies in this format. So anyway, I'm glad that you watched it. I'm glad you didn't hate it. I'm glad that it didn't totally ruin your...
No, it's great. And I'm with you. You really can watch them back to back because the settings are so different. And the second one is more comedic, and she has an awesome female sidekick.
That's right.
And I think that's a huge plus.
So. Yes, that was... I did like that. I definitely like that. So anyway, that's a non-Blu-ray, but definitely a movie worth checking out. But moving into our second disc, also from Warner Archive, we're talking about Superfly now.
Success of the new motion picture Superfly has brought Ron O'Neill to sudden nationwide attention. Here he talks about how they made the film in which he takes the title role.
Above all, I think we wanted to make a film that was realistic in content, realistic in nature. We wanted to make a film about a certain strata of the black community, which is the black hustler. Really sort of a unique kind of person. A black man becomes a hustler is because he's forced into it or led into it by a socioeconomic force. Because being a hustler is not a fun thing. And we show this rather clearly in the movie.
If don't argue with me, man. I'm trying to give you a chance. Now, you don't get me my money today.
Move a muscle and I'll kill you.
Kill me, Ridden. Kill me like you kill Scatter, and you are one dead pig. This whole number is something I thought I wanted ever since I was a kid. My hall, my vines, that wine you drinking. And a woman like you.
Don't you feel that way anymore?
I don't know.
8-track stereo, color TV in every room, and can snort a half a piece of dope every day. That's the American dream.
Superfly is about people who don't believe in the American dream at all, have no reason to. Priest, indeed, is a great deal more American than the American dream.
We didn't make a film about the rise and great success of a hustler. We made a film about a guy who has all the creature comforts, all the material possessions that any black person can see, you know, in real life on the street. We made a film about a guy who has all of this and whose whole action throughout the film is to indeed get out of the life, to get out of the business, to try to better his condition. It's having a choice. Being able to decide what it is I want. Not just to be forced into a thing because that's the way it is. Well, buy me some time, baby.
And will that make you happy?
I don't know. I don't know. I just know I can't be happy the way it is now. I never was.
So you had not seen Superfly before, correct?
Correct.
I'm not shaming you. It's not.
No, I know you aren't. I'm shaming myself.
Well, see, I don't think, I don't know. I don't believe in that stuff, really. I mean, I just think there's so many movies that I know for a fact that you have seen that a lot of people haven't seen, that there's just no movie that
it just evens it out.
Well, I don't think it goes beyond that, because I feel like there's no movie that you haven't seen that I would ever be like, Steph, come on, how have you not? That doesn't apply to you. You know, you've transcended that, in my opinion. So anyway, the other thing about that is it's nice when you can get a chance to see a movie like this on Blu-ray for the first time. Now, unfortunately, Superfly is a lower budget film, and it definitely looks that, but it still looks better than it's ever looked on this disc. So for people that don't know the story of Superfly, it's really basically about a drug dealer, cocaine dealer named Priest, played by Ron O'Neill, who is trying to get out of the life. He's realizing that where he's at now is either going to end with him in prison or he's going to be dead. And so he comes up with this plan to, he's saving up a bunch of money. He's going to buy a bunch of keys of cocaine. Is it 30 keys or 300? I can't remember now. I think it was 30.
You can't ask me numbers.
I think it was 30. No, it's 30 keys.
Yeah, 30 sounds right.
Because he has 300 grand and I think it's 10 grand a key. So that's his thing. He's like, I'm going to get these keys. I'm going to sell the 30 keys and I'm out. I'm going to retire. But much like the mafia, you know, you can't get out of the life that easily. So that's sort of the conflict or the drama of the movie. But so, Steph, what did you think of the Priest character and of the movie itself?
So this is a film it's a landmark. You know, it's one of those social touchstones on top of being a film. So when you're going into that, I was very aware of that going in. So as a film, it's absolutely one of the best blaxploitation movies, at least that I've seen.
Cool.
It's an incredibly cohesive plot. And I don't mean that to, you know, kind of, you know, sound dismissive. But, you know, sometimes there'll be like a loose plot and it'll just be an excuse for like action. And this one, Youngblood Priest is such a rich character. Like he has a past, a criminal past, and he's actively committing crimes, but, you know, he kind of has his own set of, okay, this is why I'm doing it, so I can get out of it. You know, but you don't take advantage of these people. You have to do it this way. And he's always looking above and beyond. Like, yeah, I'm getting my hands dirty right now, but that's not the goal. Like, you know, it's for the long game. It's not for the short game. And it makes for a very complex character. And it's really interesting to watch because with Cleopatra Jones, she's very pure. She's just like you equating her to superheroes. She's just very pure. Priest is not pure at all, but no. You still want to see him come up on top. And part of that is because there are greater evils than him. There are the corrupt cops. The mafia is involved as well. And, you know, other drug dealers who, you know, they're not looking at it as this is something we were pulled into unwillingly or, you know, I need to figure out something else to do. They kind of revel in it. So there's a comparison in there that works in his favor, but mostly it's just because he has layers, he's complex. And Ron O'Neill's performance, he put so much thought into it. And there's so much heart and nuance to it. And yeah, this is it's a fun, badass movie with an incredible soundtrack.
Oh my God.
Like everything cool about it's a movie called Superfly and it lives up to it. It's that cool of a movie. But it's not a stupid movie. It's thoughtful. It was really keyed into what was going on at the time.
Oh yeah. No. Absolutely.
Deeply so. And I think it keeps it fresh. And I can see why they wanted to remake it just last year.
Yeah.
I don't think they needed to.
No.
But yeah, unfortunately, a lot of things that has to say about society are still very, very much, I'm at a loss for words.
Yeah. No, I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. Yeah. It's really interesting. The Priest character, like you say, very nuanced. I mean, listening to the extras and features on this, like I didn't know, I'm not surprised, but Ron O'Neill is a stage actor, you know, had apparently done some Shakespeare in his time. You know, I mean, he's a real true pro, which totally comes through when you think about it. But one of the things I noticed upon this viewing was how conflicted Priest is a lot of the time about a lot of things, but certainly about having to be and keep up the sort of badass persona. Like he has this really interesting insecurity that plays every time he has to like throw down, you know, with somebody, you can see that he's like, I'm serious. But there is this other layer of like, I'm not happy to be doing this. And maybe another layer of like, I'm not fully confident that they're going to do what I want them to do, but I'm still going to project what I need to project because that's part of the business. And he plays those scenes like really well, and it works. Most of the time, the projected image and the projected badassness gets people to do what he wants, but there are occasions when it doesn't, and he has to sort of find another angle, you know? Like when he's trying to buy some cocaine from this older gentleman, Scatter, who had gotten coke from before, you know, and it doesn't work the one way, then he has to start like playing off of like another angle, you know? So he knows how to manipulate people, but I feel like there's still a sensitivity, you know, that makes him feel right. More human than like John Shaft, for instance, you know? I think Shaft is like, I like Shaft. I think it's a fun, you know, performance, a fun movie, but it's much more...
about the image.
Yeah, well, definitely about the image, but just about a movie. It's a movie. Like, and Superfly is a movie, but it also is kind of a... There's a part of it that's documenting some things that are going on, and it feels like that sort of, you know, quasi-documentary feel, and it's really about, at least as far as the extras are indicating, a lot of it is about the options available to African Americans at that time in the urban areas. You know, it's a sort, I mean, cliche that you have pimps and drug dealers as roles that, you know, Black people play in movies, but in terms of things that could make a lot of money in that socioeconomic setup, those are two of the big ones. And this movie is playing on the idea that these characters are doing the best with what they have available to them, and yet that they realize that it's not where they want to be, you know, despite all that. So I think the social observation side of Superfly was something I hadn't picked up on as much before. I guess I found it like depressing or something, you know. I was just like, oh, he's a drug dealer, I don't like him, or something. I don't know. That was one of my initial takes on the movie. And I found it a way more nuanced, like you said, performance this time than that. And, you know, I don't know. And then there was something that came up in the commentary too, was the idea that cocaine was in its, not infancy, but it hadn't fully taken off and become as problematic as it would in the 1980s. So,
right, like they didn't view it as a dangerous or overly addictive drug.
Yes. So it's not, so heroin obviously is a problem in that right way. But so you think of what he's doing, and in the case of when it came out, it would be seen as somebody who's just selling recreational drugs that aren't necessarily hurting anybody as much. They definitely don't show that as much, except at the beginning when you have the junkies trying to score. And I can't remember if they're trying to score coke or heroin. Probably coke, I guess. But anyway, so like there is a sympathetic part of that character based on the time the movie came out that I also didn't fully absorb. It's a complex film. It really is, you know, much more than you would think with a name like that.
Right. It doesn't glamorize the lifestyle, but doesn't demonize it either. It really is kind of just a fact of where the characters are right now. And I think I agree with you with the comparison with Shaft, that the difference between this one is you really see both sides. You do see that he is a badass and he can handle his shit and people respect him and are intimidated by him. But they show that the character is using that as a tool. Like, he doesn't view himself as untouchable, but he needs to make himself look untouchable. And we see his vulnerable moments. We see him second guessing himself. We see him like slowly discovering things by talking to different characters. And I think that's really what is one of the things that pushes it over.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, between that and the soundtrack, which is, you know, and I'm not trying to be facetious, but maybe one of the greatest soundtracks for a film ever done, as far as I'm concerned. And I love the Shaft soundtrack. I think Isaac Hayes is amazing. But the way that this soundtrack plays into the movie itself, it functions as something of a Greek chorus that is, commenting on the film and criticizing what's going on screen, and incredibly amazing in terms of the songs. These are just some of the greatest songs of all time. Like, for me, I just love Curtis Mayfield and I love his music. And I love the idea that he made some of the songs and finished them while they were shooting the movie. And so they could play, and obviously we've heard this before, people playing the music on set, and that's great. But can you imagine being on set and hearing this music for the first time, you know, and how that would infect your performance? Like, how incredible would that be to hear this music and be like, holy shit. Like, I can't imagine that wouldn't make everything better and richer, you know? I think it's incredible.
Absolutely. No, almost like you're like, oh, this is legit.
Yeah.
This yeah. movie is probably going to do well if this is what it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, I think soundtrack is something that is still a little bit underrated in terms of the impact and the overall pull it can give to a movie with an audience. And yeah, this soundtrack is incredible. His voice is incredible. There was something about the soundtrack and the character, but I was like, is this the blaxploitation Easy Rider? You know, like, you have this pursuit of freedom and self-determination, which Priest is looking for. And obviously Easy Rider opens, they're doing a big drug deal to get their wad of cash to go and take off. So there was something about it that felt like an urban set, you know, Easy Rider thematic somehow, you know, I don't know. But also, the other thing that's interesting is it came out the same year as The Godfather. And I think that's fascinating because there's definitely some parallels with that, you know, for sure. So anyway, all those things said, soundtrack, thematics, performances, it's a really, really strong movie. And I'm glad you dug it. I'm not surprised you dug it in any way. But I had underrated this one, I think, because I had some weird impression of the Priest character, like I didn't like him or something in the first viewing or second viewing of this movie. And I was able to appreciate the complexity of his character much more this time.
Yeah, I think the reputation of it, especially the theme song and the title, that can give a lot of fame to the film and also a lot of infamy that can just be kind of glamorous hurdles for a real film to jump when it actually has substance. So I had a feeling I'd be like, oh, Superfly, that'll be super fun. I was like, oh, there's amazing acting, a really complex script, very complex characters in this that I wasn't expecting, which, you know, says more about me than anything, but it was a wonderful surprise. I like this a lot more than I was expecting to, and I had high expectations. So
that's cool. What did you think of the extras?
The extras are great. It seems like they all had copyright 2003, so I guess they're from the DVD.
Yeah, there's nothing new. Okay. Unfortunately. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, this is the way I look at it with the Warner Archive stuff. I'm like, okay, they didn't spend the money to make new extras, but they did spend the money to make the transfer look good. So you kind of have to go, okay, well, I can get one or the other. Sometimes I can get both, sometimes not. But anyway, it's nice when the extras exist because they're pretty good. I mean, you've got a commentary track with Dr. Todd Boyd of USC, professor of cinema and television, and author of Am I Black Enough for You? Popular Culture from the Hood and Beyond.
A lot of people get confused around this term blaxploitation. And the history of the word is really interesting. Back in the 70s, a lot of people began calling these movies black exploitation movies. And over time, you know, the two words were sort of shortened into one, blaxploitation. This term is very historically specific in my mind. It has to do with the body of films released between the early 70s and the mid 70s, even though people sort of freely use that word to apply to black films from any time that happened to have some sort of gangster element. But these were not just, you know, gangster films. What they were films targeted at urban inner city audiences. And initially, they were quite powerful. And Superfly is one of the early examples of how successful blaxploitation films could be. Over time, Hollywood began making many of these, and they sort of completely devalued them of any substance or politics, and they got to be just camp or kitsch, just laughable. But Superfly comes at the front end of the genre, and I think it indicated to audiences and to studios that you can make these low-budget urban films, present them to an urban audience, and make huge box office profits. And this is a model that Hollywood, you know, still relies on today. Blaxploitation, though, does not apply to any film that happens to be black and gangster. It applies to a specific historical period, and there have been a number of people that have maybe appropriated elements of blaxploitation. But blaxploitation, like, say, film noir, is historically specific, and that's something that people often don't know.
And he's great, and he's also in the One Last Deal, a retrospective documentary. It's like a 23 or 24 minute mm-hmm. like making of kind of thing, but he's really good on the commentary. What did you think of him?
He's fantastic. For one thing, he right. has an actor quality voice.
Yes,
so is a joy to listen to him. But he's great because he's not really talking about the filmmaking per se, but more of how things fit into what was going on socially at the time.
Yeah.
And that was really interesting. And, you know, there might, if you're a random white person like I am, there are some things in the film that will probably fly over your head. And he just kind of casually explains the deeper meaning of that. And yeah, it's pretty much the perfect commentary.
Well, I know a lot of people look at it and dismiss it, and they think, oh, you know, the clothes are outdated and the car's outdated and it's such a relic. But they're missing the point, because that movie was serious, stylistically and thematically. And at the end, you know, Ron O'Neill basically tells the white man to kiss his ass and walks off and jumps in his tricked out hog. I mean, you know, that's John Wayne riding off in the sunset for black people.
Yeah, really well suited track. And yeah, he just covers a lot of, like, he's clearly an older guy, and so he saw it and felt some of the impact of it when he was younger, and saw, you know, people emulating Priest in, you know, getting their hairstyles changed and things like that.
Yeah, he's like, I swear, the day after this came out, people were getting their hair relaxed.
Yeah, so he's, you know, but he also talks about, you know, other sort of social things that were happening around that time, and, you know, how things were changing from the late 60s to the 70s. And yeah, he's just a cool guy. Like, you're just like, I'd like to hang out with this guy. He seems like a good dude, you know, and just really fun and relaxed and enjoying watching the movie and, you know, not looking down on it, but definitely like mentioning a few things that may or may not play quite as well today kind of things. Mm-hmm. You know, without being unkind. So yeah, he's great. And then this making of was really neat too, because I just got so much more of a sense of how much of an independent production it was. You know, it's put out by a big studio, but it's clearly a movie that, like, was not easy to get made, and they had to make it very cheaply. I mean, they're talking about, like, how cast and crew are pulling cable and how they're having to deal with, like, gang members wanting a piece of the move, you know, a piece of money to film in their neighborhood, and just, you know, lots of shit that sounds like it was difficult to deal with, you know, like, it just doesn't sound like it was an easy production, but it sounds like a production that a lot of people were putting a lot of heart into. And so you get a weird, that which is weird to say about a movie about a drug dealer, but that there's a genuine sense of, like, excitement about this topic and what they're depicting, and that this movie's important and that this soundtrack is important. And yeah, it was just, I don't know, it feels like the little scrappy movie that could, based on the description you get from the making of, I thought.
Yeah, and you do see it in the film. Like, this isn't, you know, like, one perfect shot. You don't normally see something from Superfly. It's just kind of a lot of two shots, just very simple things, very tight in, almost like they don't want to show the whole of a room. They just want to focus on one wall, and you can kind of sense that. So it really, yeah, it almost feels like it's just more of for the people than, you know, people going into, like, oh, the mise en scene in this. It's It's more for people who really want to connect to a story, who want to connect to characters, and, you know, a banging soundtrack.
Yeah, it's really, the soundtrack is amazing.
Like that's where its value is, I think. It's the heart, for sure. It's,
oh yeah, that too.
I mean, Priest looks amazing. Again, like his outfit and the cars, forget about it. But, you know, it's a gritty looking movie.
Yeah, that is the difference between the two. It's intriguing that both the Priest character and Cleopatra Jones are equally pretty amazingly dressed. But, you know, the grit you can definitely feel in Superfly in the way that it's shot. And it's less glamorous in that respect. But yeah, Ron O'Neill is styling. Like, he's got, like, there's a jacket he was wearing where it was like belted up in the middle. And I was just like, did he belt himself into that jacket? It was just like this really crazy, like it had buckles across the front in this way that I was like, that looks like he buckled himself into that jacket. But damn, it looks good.
Beauty is pain, man. Sometimes you have to buckle yourself into something.
Yeah. So yeah, that's good that it gave me a greater sense of the movie. And then there's a great Ron O'Neill interview, which I'd probably open this section with, at least part of it. It's just really neat to hear him talk about the movie and what they were going for.
You know, you got this fantasy in your head about getting out of the life and setting that other world on its ear. What are you going to do except hustle?
He's not going to go down Madison Avenue and start an ad agency, I can tell you that. He's not going to become a Jesuit priest. That's all these things are kind of unrealistic. It's not really the issue, you know. The issue is how he got to be where we find him. My gut response to him would be respect for survival. You know, I wouldn't particularly treasure his company. But I would respect his intelligence, his courage, if you will. I don't think I'd be a running buddy of his. He's into his thing and I'm into mine.
Yeah, like filmed at the time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that in a couple of DVDs over the years where he's like, he's just jogging and kind of talking about his approach to the film and narration. Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, some of those vintage featurettes are, they're very fluffy, and this is a little bit, but you can definitely tell this is special. And that
I don't care. They're just like a little slice of the time period. I love them.
Oh yeah, I like them. No, I like them too. I much prefer them to fluffy stuff today, because I feel like there was just a little bit more interest in the actors, or the actors having a little more interest in doing what they're doing, even when they're saying some of the stuff that they say now. But I feel like when I hear people say certain things now, like so-and-so was so great to work with and blah, 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 I'm just like, oh man, why do we even have you here?
I know you're lying.
This is just a waste. Like, anyway. So that's really cool. And then there's a really great short interview with Curtis Mayfield where he talks about the soundtrack and
audio only, but it's great.
Superfly. Not only through the script and his character, but being the first movie score introduced to me really had me in a mode for wanting to be involved. I'd worn a lot of hats, but this was the first time to be taken in as someone that might write a movie score. For film, I usually would follow a script. And the script and its contents and all the characters and what the story was about would basically furnish me with ideas and depth to get actually into the happenings of that particular movie for scoring. However, when you're writing just in general, you use the society and the happenings about yourself and your observances. That becomes your script. And the feelings of yourself as well as other people. Everything I write about doesn't necessarily happen to me, but in observing and being sensitive, you can take on the contents and characters of just people in general.
Yeah, that was like a little bit more of a sober, like really looking back on his career kind of interview.
Yeah, no, it was interesting. Very soulful. And it was interesting to hear some of the places that he draws from creatively, personally. And Yeah, no, and it's real, but the music is just beautiful. And you listen to the lyrics and they're so, again, complex. You know, they play on multiple levels. They play as, you know, wonderful songs that you could listen to on the radio, but also have so much going in the poetry of them that plays to both a dark side and potential light side of, you know, what's happening in these neighborhoods and stuff. But yeah, it's like one of my favorite Greek choruses, I think, in any movie ever, because it's just so delightful to listen to.
Yeah. And if you're someone who doesn't usually have the subtitles on, they subtitle the lyrics to the songs too. And nice. These are very deep and specific lyrics. So yeah, it's definitely worth not only diving deeper into the film, but the soundtrack. Because yeah, it's catchy and fun on the top, but you know, there's a lot going on there.
Good stuff. Well, I'm glad you dug it, Steph. Before we go, what else did you get from the Warner Archive sale?
Oh, I'll try to think of it off the top of my head. I finally upgraded The Thing from Another World.
Nice.
I finally got, I'd have to get my order. I don't have a good memory.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No, it's okay.
But that's cool. I meant to get something myself and I did not.
I got Black Scorpion. I've been curious about seeing that one.
Oh, nice. Raven and I talked about that one. Yeah, that's fun. That's a fun one. I like those big monster movies they've been doing. Both Scream Factory and Warner Archive are putting out the 50s sci-fi stuff. And
I'm such a sucker for that.
Me too. Big time. Just got the Deadly Mantis the other day and Cyclops from Warner Archive. And I feel like there's another one that just came out. Mole People. Anyway, well, Steph, thank you for talking Blaxploitation with me tonight.
Yeah, thank you for having me, as always.
No, it's always a pleasure. And I'm excited for our next episode that we're going to do. I'm not going to say what it is, but I know that you've said that it is one of the films we're going to cover is one of your favorite movies of all time. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
Easily.
So that's a nice tease for the next one. It's going to be really neat. And I'm very curious to hear your thoughts. I'm very curious to watch the movie again. It's not currently available just yet. Not until late this month, but
unless you have it on DVD like I do.
Well, of course.
Humble brag.
Yes. Humble brag. Yes, of course.
I own a DVD.
Well done.
Jealous?
Very much. Very much. I had it too, but I don't know what I did with it. Did I keep it or sell it?
You probably sold it like a smart guy when you could actually get money for it.
I may have, because I was able to get it on my digital for a little while, but I might have given up some extras on there, which was dumb. So I got to remember what I did with it. But anyway, still haven't given away what the movie is. You'll have to wait and see. But I'm excited to talk to Steph about that one. So look forward to that. Anyway, shutting up. Everybody have a lovely and Blu-ray filled week. And we will talk to you very soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.